Welcome to the Historical Gad Club, a podcast devoted to history, current events, good books, and the connections between all three. I'm your host, Timothy Noonan, a graduate student at the University of Oxford. Our email address is historicalgadfly@gmail.com. If you have any questions or suggestions or ideas for future episodes, we'll be glad to hear them. And as always, thanks for tuning in. So yet another fake summer day here in Oxford. It's July 21st, according to my stopwatch, and yet we still have rain, we still have overcast skies, and we still even have a bit of drizzle coming in. But I'm still doing okay, because on this episode of the Historical Gadfly, we're coming full circle in some ways, because we're having on our show Brittany Morial, who's actually from a place that I know quite a bit about, but is talking about a place that I know almost nothing about. Brittany is a graduate student here at Oxford working on South Sudan, which, unless anybody has declared independence in the last 2 or 3 weeks, I suppose, is the current world's newest country. So Brittany, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So to start off and to start off with a topic that's dear to my heart, where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in Los Angeles, and I was actually born in San Pedro, but mm-hmm. I was raised in Palos Verdes, and now my family still lives in Palos Verdes.
So. And how did your parents end up in Palos Verdes, or how did your family end up there? And what do you, looking back, what impact do you think that growing up in either Pedro or Palos Verdes made on your life?
Yeah, the move from San Pedro to Palos Verdes was all about our education, and just the school district in Palos Verdes is one of the better ones in Los Angeles, and so it had everything to do with my sister and my interest in education and our development. And so, we were very thankful for our parents to take us there. We went to Palos Verdes right at the beginning of middle school. So, it was a great time to...
And just for context, I mean, just for full disclosure, I grew up in Palos Verdes. I didn't... I spent time in Pedro, but have really not ever lived there. Mm-hmm. My impression was always, I mean, San Pedro seemed to me like kind of this odd place in America where... it's basically next to the harbor for Los Angeles, and it seemed like even at a time of post-industrial development across much of the country, St. Peter seemed like this area where there still was actually kind of a working-class culture, but a lot of the jobs with it. So you have, like, longshoremen.
Right.
Would you use that as an accurate impression of what St. Peter was like was like in the late 90s?
Definitely, yeah. I think that's pretty accurate. And my family ended up in San Pedro because they were fishermen. And mm-hmm. So my grandparents came over from Italy and mm-hmm. Were fishing in San Pedro. And so that's our roots. And we still have most of our family in San Pedro and a good portion of our family working at the dock as longshoremen. And so, it's still a place we visit often. And it's a fun niche, but Palos Verdes is also a beautiful area. And we went there for education, and it seems to have paid off. So,
it's always interesting with immigrant communities. I believe there's mm-hmm. a big Croatian diaspora in San Pedro and kind of Long Beach area as well. So it's interesting to see how, in some ways, Southern Europe Southern Europe, you would call it, replicated itself in this one niche in the LA area. But what did both of your parents do, and what influence do you think they had on you growing up?
Mm-hmm. My mom worked several jobs in a restaurant in San Pedro, and then eventually at the city hall in Palos Verdes, and a couple other mm-hmm. jobs along the way. And my dad always worked as an accountant for city halls, so mm-hmm. He was working in Manhattan Beach most of my childhood, and then now he's working up in Los Altos.
Okay.
And so, continuing with the city.
And so, when you were in high school, at that point, I suspect that you weren't thinking about South Sudan, let alone what you came to do in undergrad, which we'll get in a second. Who do you think were your most formative teachers at that point, or how did you start to become more interested in academics or studying? What was going on at that age, that secondary level, that you think was starting to get you more interested in the broader world?
Okay, I was absolutely fascinated with Japanese and Japanese culture, and mm-hmm. My best friend from kindergarten was Japanese, and so even from that young age, we'd started, like, singing songs together, and she started teaching me a little bit of the language, and so then in high school, I really dove into it, and along with that, I had a very influential physics teacher, mm-hmm. and that kind of led me to my undergrad degree in physics. Mm-hmm. And so the kind of the combination of this Japanese friend and our dreams of always visiting Japan and my fascination with Japanese culture and the physics kind of led me to my undergrad path.
And where did you do your undergraduate studies?
I did undergrad at Air Force Academy, mm-hmm. and I studied physics and had a Japanese minor.
Okay. And I guess for viewers and partly for myself, the service requirements, are they the same at the Air Force Academy versus the other schools? And was that a complicated decision for either you or your family deciding to go to Service Academy?
Yeah, it was a long decision, but I was recruited for cross country. And mm-hmm. so the Air Force Academy and West Point were the two service academies I looked at. And then I looked at four or five other civilian institutions. And I just couldn't pass up the Air Force Academy after I went and visited and then fell in love with it. And so I have a 5-year commitment just out of the academy, and mm-hmm. then I have to pay 9 years because of these extra 3 years that I'm going to take here.
Right, right. And so you should tell us a little bit about, so you come into Air Force, I guess, thinking that mm-hmm. you're going to do physics. Was it, or was it that simple? I mean, were there potential tangents, or were there moments of, oh my God, what am I doing? Or talk a little bit about kind of how you made it to the finish line, no pun intended, mm-hmm. but, you know, doing both cross-country, but also kind of trying to figure out which direction you're going in intellectually.
Yeah, I actually had no idea when I entered what I wanted to do. I, you know, had this influential physics teacher, and I love physics, but I didn't know if that was the path I wanted. And in my freshman and sophomore year, we didn't have to declare till the end of sophomore year.
Yeah.
In freshman and sophomore year, I really clicked with a lot of the engineering classes, and mm-hmm. so I thought that I wanted to go along an engineering path, and I just couldn't decide which engineering path I wanted, and so I figured if I want to do my master's degree in some type of engineering, then I want to choose something that'll allow me the most wiggle room and flexibility. Exactly. So I started talking to some of my professors, and they suggested physics, and that it would be a good route to any of the different engineerings. Mm-hmm. So I ended in physics.
And then on the side of Japanese, I mean, the more you've sort of immersed yourself in this language or the culture of the country, how accurate or how does your interest in the country change or grow or dissipate the more you kind of engaged with the culture and society?
The Japanese was the one given when I went to the Air Force mm-hmm. Academy. I knew from day one I was going to be in Japanese, and I fell in love with the program at the Air Force Academy, and I got to spend 6 months in Japan in Nagasaki while I was at the Academy, and that was such a wonderful gift from the Air Force and mm-hmm. my undergrad education, and I fell in love even more with the people and the country.
And I mean, this is almost a slight tangent, but mm-hmm. When we talk about places like Okinawa or like U.S. bases in East Asia, what role does Japan play today in that overall strategic plan, or like how tied is the Air Force as an institution with Japan in terms of strategic planning or that kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm. We have 3 Air Force bases in Japan, mm-hmm. and then there's a couple Marine bases as well, and maybe 1 or 2 Navy bases. And so the U.S. military is very closely tied with Japan. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there has been some recent controversy, especially with the bases on Okinawa, the Marine bases. But I think there's a very close collaboration between the U.S. and Japanese military. And so I think into the far future, we will be working closely with Japan and with the Japanese military.
Yeah. And at this stage, I mean, again, both exposing my own ignorance, but maybe for viewers who don't know a lot about the service academies, at this stage, like, does one declare at a certain point, I'm going to be a pilot, or I'm going to be a pilot of a specific type of wing or a specific type of plane? How does kind of the pre-professional or pre-military, maybe we can call it, training work at the Air Force Academy, and then how did that integrate with your interests in engineering, I guess, in the future, but also Japanese studies?
Right. At the end of our junior year, we have a big celebration where we all find out what our job is going to be. And prior to that, so that's kind of a fun day. But prior to that, we all make a wish list and get recommendations from anybody who we think could write a good recommendation for us. And it goes before a board, and the Air Force will rank us, and then the first ranked person will get the job they want, and it'll go down by the needs of the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And so about 50% from the academy get pilot.
Okay.
And then the other 50% do all types of things. So
I think that I wonder how many parallels there are between West Point and the Air Force Academy in the following regard. I know that a lot of friends of mine who have gone to West Point would say there are definite cultural divides between people interested in certain professional cones, let's say. Like, I think especially among guys,
infantry
is like, sort of, I'm tough, like, I have the biggest, you know what, and so on and so forth. Whereas, like, I just remember knowing a guy here at Oxford last year who was doing missile defense, which I think is obviously important, but I know that he'd gotten a lot of, insults almost, or kind of, emasculating, suggestions or whatever from friends because he was not, like, tough enough to be doing infantry. And then again, when I've met people doing Ranger School or doing SEALs, there seems to be this focus on, like, infantry, like, actual fighting or whatever, in terms of toughness. Is there a similar kind of hierarchy of positions, and how does it play out within the Air Force, at least at the Service Academy level?
Yeah, I think there are quite a bit of differences between West Point and the Air Force Academy, and, I mean, maybe the Air Force Academy is the softest of all the services, but I think there's a little slight divide maybe between pilots and everybody else. They just have this, like, scarf blowing in the wind, kind of image in their head. But those are the good old days, and really now we're just playing with remote control airplanes and stuff like that. And, of course, there are still fighter jets and bombers that play a very important mission, but no, the times are changing, and, yeah, our focus is changing to cyberspace and space a whole lot more even than flight sometimes. But no, I feel like, and especially, I guess, at West Point, another big issue is the women and men and the jobs that the women can do. But luckily in the Air Force, the women are completely integrated, and so we can do everything from fighters to intel and everything. So, yeah, so I didn't feel like there was as much of a cultural divide at the Academy.
Okay. And
friendly.
And what job was, like, on the top of your list, and why?
Pilot.
Okay.
That was at the top of my list, and I'm still waiting on a height waiver
for
that. But, yeah, I'm an inch too short. So as long as that height waiver comes through, then it'll be pilot. I just thought I was, young and might as well enjoy this wonderful opportunity to learn to fly. And, I don't know, flying fighters would be awesome.
But you get the sense that, I mean, what you were just saying about the sort of IT stuff or electronics and so on, do you get the sense, like, sort of, I'm not even sure if we can talk about piloting an F-16 as being, like, the normal gig, but is like, flying a plane still kind of what excites you the most, or are there other more maybe cutting-edge areas that, like, seem, like, actually more exciting, or how do you think about that?
I guess, I mean, the ultimate job for me in the Air Force would probably be as an air attaché working in one of the embassies, hopefully in Africa, but because I like the focus of the missions in Africa on more humanitarian type work.
And what does an air attaché do?
Basically, you work with the heads of foreign air forces, and so you're the representative for the Air Force in that embassy.
Okay.
And yeah, a lot of diplomatic work,
but
also coordinating of missions within the country that you're based. It does excite me to be in a cockpit and flying a plane and traveling the world and all that, but it's kind of just a stepping stone to the ultimate goal of air attaché or working, even before that, maybe in the Pentagon at some point.
Right.
Then going overseas, so.
And I guess maybe the last question about Air Force before we move on to sort of what happens afterwards. Here at Oxford, clearly you interact with, and I think especially in your class of Rhodes Scholars, there's clearly, I shouldn't say abnormal, but there's more women from service academies than I think there typically is in a given year. When you've spoken with people who went to, I forget if there's any from Navy this year, but I guess when you speak with women from West Point, can you talk a little bit about how you think the Air Force, how good a job they do in terms of, like, making sure that women are getting into leadership positions, or what worked the best for you, and maybe comparing that to what seems to have been the experience of friends or colleagues who went to West Point?
Yeah, we've actually discussed this quite a bit, because there are three female Army officers in our class and two graduates from West Point. And I feel like there's a vast difference between the treatment of women in the Air Force Academy versus West Point. And it's probably because of the immediacy of the, deployments once they graduate from West Point, and the gravity of the work that they're doing right on the front lines. But at the Air Force Academy, I feel like there's much more of a brother and sisterhood feeling than the maybe competitive or the gulf that's between women and men at West Point. Mm-hmm. So I'm really thankful for that. And yeah, happy I ended up where I did. But
Right. Even
so, West Point's a great place.
So I guess, I imagine with the way this bidding list works, you must have had an eventful senior fall between that and the interviews and so on. So mm-hmm. So you graduated, I guess, this previous spring, correct, or this previous summer.
Mm-hmm.
So going into the, I guess, a year ago, I suppose, or 2 years ago, I guess, you're doing the bid list, and you're also applying for fellowships. So what happens once you sort of get the call that you've received this award and that you're actually going to Oxford? When you have this panorama of choices ahead of you, how do you figure out, okay, I have 2 or 3 years to kind of reorient or try to reinvent what I'm doing? What were sort of some of the options you played with, or maybe some of the options you junked prior to settling on the one you didn't know? I mean, I know I personally thought of like probably 10 multiple lives I could pursue besides
Absolutely.
Really not making a decision and ending up on the path that I am now. But
Right. What
was that process like for you? And then how did you spend that, I guess, winter and spring trying to figure out, okay, I have this opportunity to expand or go in a different direction intellectually. Like, what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess the big change in direction would be from physics to anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
And that was mostly driven by my desire to not be a physicist in the Air Force. And that was only because I had gotten a taste of the physics career field in the Air Force during junior year, and I'd found that it was not at all what I wanted. And I didn't want to just be looking over contractors or mm-hmm. stuck in a cave or something. I had these idealized images of doing real work with physics and space and all this, but
mm-hmm.
NASA program was cut down dramatically, and the other work in the Air Force didn't excite me as much. And so then, yeah, my sights moved to pilot and air attaché eventually.
Right.
And that's where anthropology came in. And, I had always loved my Japanese minor and loved getting immersed in the culture. And so I figured that it worked well with my interests and my love of meeting people and learning different cultures.
Okay. So the way I think about this is, I think when I speak with people who made what other people perceive as this huge shift, it's always interesting to talk to the person. I think most of the time,
right.
at least in your own head, it's not, you don't view yourself as like abandoning the one
right.
thing. And then going
certainly
to,
not, no.
That's it. I didn't really know about how the Air Force had like this sort of physics cone, or like there was sort of a special
right.
career for physicists within
right.
it, but
mm-hmm.
that's interesting. So you come to Oxford, and then I guess you show up having declared for what, an MSc or a 1 year master's degree, or for the
MPhil.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
okay.
Yeah.
So you enter that. At that point, you know that you're interested in foreign cultures. Was there an inclination towards Africa at that point, or were you still kind of like, we'll see what happens?
Right. I was kind of all around, but I was certainly interested in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So that interest came along with me. And I guess the only thing that kept me from doing that is that I don't think I have the ability to read the text that I would need to read, and especially maybe some of the more archival work that
yeah.
I might need to do would be a real challenge for me in Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
Conversationally, I'd be okay, but mm-hmm. when it came to research, it might be really tough.
Right.
So that kind of veered me away from Japanese, and my other interest had been in East Africa.
Mm-hmm.
During my senior year, I'd gone to Kenya and spent some time with refugees there. And even before that, I'd worked with a couple refugee communities in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them were Sudanese and even Southern Sudanese.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where my interest in South Sudan began. And I had a lot of learning to do, but it was a great community to be in touch with. And then when I came to Oxford, I was in St. Anthony's College.
Yep.
And we have a connection with the Sudan Center.
Okay.
And so that was just... It just seemed natural. I was going to their conferences. My advisor was next door and part of the Sudan Center. And
mm-hmm.
it was just fantastic. And it seemed like a natural fit with, like this interest that I hadn't really known how to fit into my life. And
yeah.
now it was a natural fit. So.
And let's see. Where I guess first off, what is the Sudan Center?
Mm-hmm. It's just a center that's part of St. Anthony's College, and they put on different conferences on different issues about Sudan, and so most recently they put on a conference about Sudan after the independence and how to create a sustainable peace.
Right.
And so, yeah, just maybe 4 or 5 conferences a year, and they bring in some big party leaders from Sudan. And
okay.
Great program.
So I guess to kind of get down into the meat and potatoes here, when you were beginning to learn about this region or about Sudan, well, I guess first off, when we talk about East Africa, does it make sense to, does that term like make sense, East Africa, like why do we use it, or like in what countries are just in East Africa, broadly speaking, to start off with, I guess, like maybe you could walk us through how you began to sort of assemble the pieces on the scaffolding, or how you began to construct the scaffolding to think about this region.
Yeah, especially for South Sudan, East Africa makes a lot of sense. And I think the people of South Sudan also identify very closely with East Africa and their neighbors, Kenya and Uganda and Ethiopia. So I think, yeah, there's definitely a strong connection to East Africa there and Africa in general. But yeah.
And then Sudan, what are the best places to start for an audience who's been hearing about this in the news but doesn't know a lot about the 20th century history of the country, the relationship with Egypt, relationship with Britain? There's a lot to digest here. It seems, I was reading about this yesterday, but it seems like, well, a thing that seems like would make it difficult to understand for me is, as you're pointing out, just in your response to the last question, it is kind of between, I guess what we would call the Middle East and the Arab-speaking world, but also East Africa, which is maybe like a different area studies unit or a whole different region entirely. So you kind of have to understand that or be able to reconcile these both these units at the same time. So what are the best, I don't know, concepts or kind of basic facts that we should start off with to have a productive discussion about Sudan today, you think, or South Sudan?
Right. I mean, I guess July 9th is probably the biggest date, and that would be the Independence Day for South Sudan. And I think that's a day that the Southern Sudanese have been looking forward to most of the 20th century, because really they had never identified with Northern Sudan and the Middle East in the same way that the Northern Sudanese identified with the Middle East. And so they had always viewed themselves as Africans and been more in touch with their, I don't know, more traditional roots than maybe the Northern Sudanese and Arab and Islamic culture in the north. And so July 9th is the day that they got their independence, and there's a lot of things still to be figured out with between the north and the south, especially since they share such a huge border.
Sure.
But South Sudan, you know, has very little infrastructure still, and kind of just a bare bones, you know, constitution and government set up that's still, you know, very much in flux, and it will take many years to figure out. But yeah, that's kind of where they stand now, and secular state.
Okay.
And,
yep.
Yes.
And I was reading about this a bit, and of course it's like super complicated. But why was it part of the same country as what's now, I guess, just Sudan? Why were they the same country in the first place?
Right. It was basically given independence from the British, and it was just easier at the time to leave North and South Sudan just in one big chunk. Mm-hmm. And I think even the British recognized that they were very distinct parts of, you know, and maybe even two different countries even at that time. Mm-hmm. And the British involvement in the North and South was completely different. And in the South, they allowed traditional leaders to mostly rule over rural areas, while in the North, there was much more involvement in the government. And the Northern Sudanese were very involved in a maybe more Western style type of governance than there was in the South. And so when the British gave Sudan their independence, it was just maybe some sort of convenience, and also to try to keep Egypt from taking over Sudan as well.
Right.
Because they certainly had interest in the Nile waters, and so I think it was easier for the British to give Sudan their independence and to keep Egypt away from controlling all of the Nile as well.
And I guess maybe we'll get in a few minutes to sort of the business of state building and what your research will focus on when you go there. This, I think, it was August, correct?
Yes.
But a little bit before that, to try to connect two things in more recent history, the last 10 years.
Right.
What was the Darfur conflict, and how was that connected with this current issue of South Sudan?
Yeah. Well, the Darfur conflict, actually, Darfur is in the northwest region of Japan, or sorry, of Sudan, of Sudan, and it.
It's okay. This is a topic that's new to me, so I'm like very, very self-conscious in this interview of like trying not to slip up and say things that'll like immediately lower the. People's estimation of my IQ is probably already pretty low for this podcast, but like trying to avoid slips about Africa, where it's like, oh my god.
Yeah. So Darfur is in the northwest region of Sudan, and they are traditionally Muslim and have tribal structures in the same way that most of Sudan does. Mm-hmm. And basically, there's a lot of connections between North and South, and it's a very complicated conflict. But originally, the northern government had used some of the Darfuri warriors to be involved in the civil war between North and South. Mm-hmm. And so many Darfuris had come and fought against the people of South Sudan. And when the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed between the North and the South, which stopped the civil war, the Darfuris retreated back to Darfur. Mm-hmm. And their promises, the North had promised that they would get southern Sudanese land for being involved in the civil war, but these promises, of course, could never be fulfilled because of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And so then the Darfuris started making demands of the northern government because the promise had not been fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they'd lost many lives as well. And then the northern government waged war against the Darfuris.
Right.
And so yeah, there's a very intricate web of connections, but I'd say, now Darfur has very close ties to the South, and they are even talking about interest of their own independence or inclusion into South Sudan. They don't tend to have many resources in Darfur, and alliance with South Sudan, or maybe even later on inclusion or confederation with South Sudan may be an option that they're interested in.
Right. So sounds almost kind of a double civil war.
Yeah.
That sort of connects nicely to, I guess two questions that I think maybe tie together, which is one, who likes the current government in Khartoum in Sudan? Like what are their interests, or what do they believe they're entitled to? Mm-hmm. And then maybe tied with that, how do the recent events in Egypt during the Arab Spring change the calculus or change the sort of chessboard in the former state of Sudan or the Sudanese region or whatever you want to call it?
Right. I'm certainly much less versed in northern Sudanese politics than South Sudan, but I'd say they're much more closely aligned to the Middle East and Egypt prior to the revolutions in the Middle East recently and in northern Africa recently. And I think that the uprisings recently probably just make al-Bashir even more concerned. I mean, he's wanted by the International Criminal Court, and the second he loses power, he's going to be picked up right away and taken to trial. And so I think he's nervous, and there's a lot of voices that are being heard from the border states, of course, Abyei and Nuba Mountains, but then also the Blue Nile region and Darfur, of course. And so it almost seems like he's almost completely surrounded now by voices of unrest. And the North is definitely in a tenuous position, and they definitely need to make peace with the South, first of all, and then with the many voices within their nation. And I think Khartoum itself is a rather secular area and a rather secular city, but it as a whole, there's this rhetoric of being closely tied to Sharia law and being Arab people that is hard to reconcile when you're a huge nation in Africa. There's many diverse people with diverse backgrounds that are in your state. So, so I think those are the biggest problems that the North is going to confront still.
Sounds pretty overwhelming.
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
Like we said, you're going out to South Sudan for, I guess, about 2.5 or 2 months, it sounds like, from August to October of this year, just after the rainy season, if I remember correctly.
Right.
What do you hope to be doing there?
Right. I'm hoping to look at the incorporation of traditional leadership structures into the new Southern Sudanese government.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll spend some time in Juba doing interviews and talking to professors at the University of Juba. And then the rest of the time I'll spend in four different villages in eastern Equatoria, which is the southeasternmost state of Sudan, of South Sudan,
mm-hmm.
One of the 10 states of South Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason I'm in eastern Equatoria is just because of personal connections
okay. There,
and I've found some great people that I can travel with, which will make this first trip to Sudan a little more safe,
yeah.
And kind of a natural connection. And so I'm really looking forward to that.
So I guess this almost gets to issues of how they're building up the government or who's going to be in the government.
Right.
We talked about secular. Did you say republic, or how is this sort of thing going to be constructed?
Right. There's 10 different states mm-hmm. in South Sudan, and it's going to be a federation of these states, and each state elects governors depending on the population within each of the states, and they form the part of the legislature that's mm-hmm. in Juba, which is the capital city. And then there's, of course, a president and a vice president and the legislature and a bunch of different, Ministry of Education
yeah.
and all these different ministries that deal with different parts of infrastructure and tourism and different things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, that's the basic form of the government right now. I guess the thing that especially interests me is that each of these states will have a CODL, which is a coalition of traditional leadership authority,
mm-hmm.
and each of these CODLs will be made up of chiefs of different tribes within the region, and they're going to try to reconcile customary law with the new body of laws that's instituted by the Southern Sudanese state, and so trying to reconcile these two things that can be vastly different at times is really fascinating to me, and really it's a great means to hearing the voices from the rural populations and to getting ideas of governance and new ideas of the state out to the people within the tribes and
mm-hmm.
at the in the furthest reaches of South Sudan, which is hard to do otherwise if
yeah.
you don't have buy-in from the chiefs and you can't hear the voices of the chiefs. They'll tell us what they need us to know. So
when we talk about traditional groups, I mean, almost my impulse
as
a historian, particularly someone who does 20th century mostly, what are the traditions and are they sort of actually traditions?
Mm-hmm.
Like how long? What are these tribes and how long have they existed, or how do the leaders of them get into position? Are they egalitarian or hierarchical? Can you tell us a little bit about...
Well, I mean, there's, hundreds of different tribes across
yeah.
Sudan, and so it's hard for me to say anything...
Each one. Yeah.
Right. It's hard to say anything really general about them because
mm-hmm.
they each speak a completely distinct language, and they all have... migrated from different areas. And so a lot of the Eastern Equatoria tribes, came from other parts of Eastern Africa originally. And, I mean, Sudan is made up of tribes even that possibly came from West Africa at some point. And so, I mean, and these links are made, through different, playing with linguistics and stuff like that
yeah.
and naming
yeah.
and stuff. But it's hard to say. So each of the tribes have a different structure. For example, the Azandi have a very a strong hierarchy and a very defined chieftainship and
mm-hmm.
Structure. So that's a very easy one to play with. But then there's other tribes that are more segregated and you can't necessarily point to the head chief
okay.
or anything
yeah.
like that. And so some of the tribes I'm going to be working with are of each of those two types. And of course, I'm sure there's third and fourth different types as well. And so
yeah.
It's hard to classify when you have so many different peoples and, mixing and, some that are very separate, so.
And clearly recognizing that they're all very different, how, this is probably impossible to give a general
mm-hmm.
answer to, but how are rules or laws devised or created, at least in some
mm-hmm.
of the tribes that you'll be working with, giving a general
right.
account is probably impossible.
Right.
And then who has written the... the secular law or the
right.
the new non-tribal law that
mm-hmm.
we're going to try to be integrating with the former.
Mm-hmm. Right. The Dinka are the largest population or the largest tribe in South Sudan. And so the president is Dinka right now. Mm-hmm. And the second largest is the Nuer. And the Nuer have the vice president. And so, I mean, of course, ideally it would be all of the tribal leaders coming together and, you know, defining what the constitution looks like and stuff. But it's probably largely the voices of Dinka and Nuer.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a couple other tribal representations, but mostly Dinka and Nuer. And but other than that, the, you know, most of the tribes are governed by customary law, and I mean most of them don't even have a road that goes out to the tribe, and so there's very little contact with the government in Juba, mm-hmm. and especially during rainy season, you can't even get out there because the lands are flooded.
Right.
So, but you know, slowly infrastructure will be built and roads will go out, and then there'll be more contact between customary law and state law, and then and that's where, you know, clashes will start to happen, but that's hopefully where the codals will come into play and where they can soothe out conflicts between the customary law and the state law and decide what's right for each of the communities, and we try to spread governance even out to the furthest reaches.
My intuition tells me that there may not be a like long term sort of plan, or like not so much of a sense of like what do we want 10 or 15 years from now, but is there any sense that a centralizing state is like a bad thing in this context, or that the goal is to have like is creating a South Sudanese identity seen as a goal or a threat or both at the same time?
I think it's both at the same time, because there's certainly languages that that each tribe doesn't want to lose, and mm-hmm. Certain identities that people identify strongly with and they want to pass on to their children. But at the same time, there's a need to have a Southern Sudanese identity that's above your identity as a Dinka or a Boya or a Nuer. Mm-hmm. And because otherwise, how are you going to come together as one people when it's necessary? And there's a fine line between that. And hopefully the coalition of traditional leaders will help preserve, you know, the unique heritage, but also allow people to come together and resolve the problems that occur between each of the tribes within their states. And I think that's absolutely the key. And the key is, of course, not to have too strongly centralized of a state, because then, of course, there's going to be fingers pointed and, you know, one tribe is trying to trump another tribe. And the key is allowing each of them to have their own certain amount of autonomy while at the same time expecting that they have an allegiance to South Sudan.
Yeah. And what, as far as we can, I mean, from anything you told me, it sounds like the infrastructure is extremely basic. What are some of the other than, I mean, this sounds in itself kind of this unbelievably challenging prospect of just on the legal side, other than maybe stuff that's less interesting, just like building roads and so on, what are some of the other biggest challenges you think that kind of the political structure of South Sudan faces, or is there some consensus like this is one of the really fundamental ones?
Oh, no. Of course, water, hygiene are all issues, and then medical clinics and maternal health are huge issues, and Sudan and South Sudan especially have some of the worst maternal health in the world.
Yeah.
So, there's a whole load of issues, but I guess we just start one place at a time, and there's many NGOs that are involved, and I'm sure even more now that the South is independent and hopefully continues to remain peaceful. And hopefully remains peaceful.
Yeah.
So, yes. But, there's a lot of issues. So.
And what do you think, I mean, trying now to sort of maybe tie some of the stuff in this conversation together,
mm-hmm.
What do you think the U.S. Is sort of well-positioned to do, or sort of can do or should do within its interests to help these people, or to have play a constructive role in the formation of a stable South Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like, I mean, in particular, we've had such a complicated response to the still developing events in the Middle East.
Right.
This sounds, well, maybe more predictable, I'm not sure, but also extremely complicated.
It is,
pretty big question, but what do you think the U.S. can do constructively in this region?
Right. Well, USAID has played a huge role in, especially South Sudan, for a long time now, and they continue to put a lot of money towards infrastructure and the building of the young government and, you know, the formation of media that is fair and free to to report. But, I mean, otherwise, I think the U.S. government itself, I mean, really, they don't have, you know, any obligation to do anything. But you know, things like USAID has a big role, and then U.S. NGOs have a huge role in South Sudan, and they're going to absolutely need the help of the NGOs for a long time now. But yeah, there's lots of work to be done, and hopefully we can keep corruption out of the Southern Sudanese government, although that's certainly a challenge.
Sure, huge challenge, yeah. This makes me wonder, a friend of mine has just received his so-called bid list for being a foreign service officer.
Okay.
And I wonder, I'm not sure if we have a, I don't know, do you know if we have an embassy in Juba yet? Or?
We have an embassy in South Sudan.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That would be a fun place to go. There's a, I mean, it's, I don't know, just the formation of a young nation. I mean, this is like founding fathers are there, you know? It's incredible. So exciting.
And so I guess you'll come back here in October, November, and I suppose begin to write on some of what you've been researching on.
Right.
But maybe insofar as we can look further ahead, how do you hope that this project will like inform you know, a more long duration view of what you hope to achieve within the Air Force or within a military career? Maybe you know, if and when you leave the military, like how has this project exposed interests of yours, and how do you think you're going to carry forward this interest in Africa or state building forward over the long term, either within the military or without?
Right. Well, certainly within the military, I'm interested in being an air attaché, and so being involved in the embassies in Africa and Sudan would be a wonderful place for me to be, since I would hopefully have a pretty good understanding of the country by then.
Yeah.
And I would... It's just fascinating to me to be involved in such a young state, and I don't know, to have so much ability to maybe inform, you know, the United States and the military, and be involved in the formation of government institutions. And so, I would love to be an air attaché in Sudan or in Africa in general. And then beyond that, of course, I'm very interested in being involved in humanitarian work, even beyond the Air Force.
Yeah.
And I'm involved with a couple NGOs now, and there's so much work to be done, and I really enjoy that type of work. That's just fulfilling, I'm sure, as everybody experiences. So, I'll continue that work as well.
And I guess maybe last question, you know, obviously you're doing, like, a wonderful job thus far, and it sounds like a great project. Looking back, what advice do you think you'd give either, you know, high schoolers or younger college students, or maybe even specifically women or women in the military, if they're also interested in international affairs or kind of getting their hands involved with projects like this one that are both scholarly but also touch on global affairs? What do you think are, looking back, what do you think were the most important, like, mentorships or the kind of things you realized or the things you knew now that you wish you knew then, pieces of advice you'd give?
I mean, I think I even knew it then, but I think it's especially important in the Air Force to pursue your graduate degree, and that's a springboard for everything else. I think, you know, the special assignments within the Air Force and the opportunity to do more than just, you know, maybe sit behind a desk and analyze photographs or something. But, for me, it's changed everything, and the Air Force is much more open-minded than I even realized, and they want us to get our education and to be the best officers we can be. And so I was shocked to find how open-minded they were, and it was a wonderful realization. And so I encourage young women to go into the Air Force, and young men as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they'll find that it's a wonderful service to be part of.
And if not that, the longshoremen are still taking applications.
Right. They are. Although maybe less fun, less traveling.
Well, great. I guess if you don't have any further comments, I think that'll be that. So thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Enlightening us on a topic that I knew very little about, but feel a lot more educated on after this conversation. So thanks for coming on, Brittany.
Yeah, it was wonderful to share. Thank you.
Thanks. tuning in to The Historical Gadfly. Again, I'm your host, Timothy Noonan of the University of Oxford. If you have any questions, suggestions, or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch with us at historicalgadfly@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.